from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps of Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Well, one of my favourite comedians is Tommy Cooper. You remember him? I'm on a whiskey diet. I've lost 3 days already. I went to the doctors the other day and I said, have you got anything for wind? And he gave me a kite. Cleaned the attic with my wife the other day. Now I can't get the cobwebs out of her hair. So I said to this train driver, I want to go to Paris. He said, Eurostar? I said, well, I've been on TV, but I'm no Dean Martin. Well, hopefully that's laughs for this week on 30 Laps. He was tall, Tommy Cooper. But we're talking about a relative of his today. We're not actually talking about Tommy. No, today we're talking about his little cousin, Minnie Cooper, or more specifically, the Minnie itself, and why 20 years on, we all still love it. So with that rather strange introduction, we'll start. Hey, this comes from Classic and Sports Car magazine on the 16th of October 2020. And it was written by David Finlay. October 2020 is a poignant month for fans of the classic Mini, since it marks 2 decades since the production of the world-famous British model came to a halt. It would be fair to say the end was not premature. The little car had just passed its 41st anniversary, having been launched in August 1959, and was a long way from the sharp end of motor industry by the end of the 20th century. And yet it was as well loved in the era of the Spice Girls as it had been before the Beatles were formed, and is still remembered fondly today. And here is its story. Alec Izionis is one of the star designers of his era, and he was tasked by the British Motor Corporation in the 1950s to create a small and economical model, which was nevertheless also a real car, unlike the bubble cars which had become popular in Europe. Izionis and his team responded with a design which was innovative in several ways. One of its most impressive features, dreamed up by Alex Moulton, was a very simple suspension, using rubber cones instead of more conventional but also more expensive metal springs. Before Mini came along, and indeed for some time afterwards, European manufacturers were fond of putting the engines and gearboxes of their small cars in the back. The resulting lack of shift running through the centre of the car left more space for passengers. Cars available with this layout in the 50s and 60s included our friend the Hillman Imp, Renault 8, the Renault Daphne and the Simca 1000. But the problem with the rear engine layout was that the car's steering took up space in the front luggage department. To avoid this, Izionis packed the engine, gearbox and steering under the bonnet, leaving a rear luggage compartment almost completely untroubled by mechanical equipment. This was not, of course, a Mini innovation. Front-wheel drive had been around for many years and was unusual but not new when Citroën used it in its Traction Avant of 1934. The startling thing about Mini's front-wheel drive system was that the engine sat on top of the gearbox rather than alongside it. The two components were also mounted side by side rather than fore and aft and were so closely linked they even used the same oil. What this meant was that all the mechanicals were packed into a tiny space, leaving enough room for 4 adult passengers plus luggage in a car only 10 feet long. The engine in question was a BMC A-series, which was produced in various forms, including the modernised A+, from the days of post-war food rationing until the internet era. By the time of Mini's introduction, it had already found homes in the Austin A30, the A35, the Austin Healey Sprite, and our friend the Morris Minor, and would go on to be used in many other cars. In the Mini, the A-Series would be offered in sizes up to 1275cc. The standard capacity in 1959 was a more modest 848cc. The car's official public launch was in August 1959, and at that time was not known, even unofficially, as the Mini. Following BMC's policy of badge engineering, it was sold either as the Austin 7 or the Morris Mini Minor, though the standalone Mini name was quickly adopted by the public and later by the manufacturer. A Morris registered 621 AOK is accredited with being the first production Mini, though doubts have been expressed about this. Either way, it still exists and it's kept in the British Motor Museum. The Mini became wildly popular in the 1960s thanks to a triple whammy which may be unique in motoring history. First, it was a perfectly sensible car and quite cheap, thanks to BMC's mistake of selling each one for less than it cost to build. Second, as we'll see later, it achieved enormous publicity through success in motorsport. Third, it attracted celebrity buyers in much the same way as the Toyota Prius did many years later. Famous owners are believed to have included Twiggy, Peter Sellers, Steve McQueen, James Garner, Enzo Ferrari, and all four members of the Beatles.
Life goes on day after day.
I bet you were expecting a Beatles song then, weren't you, hey? Well, Jerry and the Pacemakers in the same town, and I kind of like that song. Anyway, back to the show. Although the original three-door saloon sedan, has by far the best-known shape, alternatives became available almost immediately. One of the first introduced in 1960 was an estate model with a slightly longer chassis, known as the Austin Mini Countryman, a name brought back for a version of the BMW Area Mini or the Morris Minor Traveller. Most, though not all, examples had ash wood exterior trim, like the larger Morris Minor Traveller, which led them to be known as Woodies, and production of those continued until 1969. The minivan was essentially a commercial van derivative of the Countryman Traveller, with no side windows or rear seats. Unlike the estate cars, it survived until the 1980s, by which time it had been rebranded as the 95. This was a reference to its gross vehicle weight, which is the maximum permissible weight, including passengers and cargo, of 0.95 ton. Yet another long-bodied Mini derivative was the pickup, which arrived in 1961. Unlike the estates, but like the van, it continued well past the end of the decade and received 95 branding for the same reason that the little van did. Perhaps the oddest Mini derivatives were the Worsley Hornet and the Riley Elf. Launched in 1961, they had protruding luggage compartments, giving a three-box shape, a slightly finned rear wings, higher equipment level, and more elaborate front-end design, involving lots of chrome. Both cars were offered in three generations throughout the 1960s and until production was brought to an end in 1969. Here's one that was quite famous in Australia. The Moke, the Mini Moke, was simple and rugged, a Mini-based vehicle initially intended for military use. When that plan came to nothing, it was repurposed as a civilian vehicle and proved to be popular in countries with hot climates. Similar in concept to the Citroën Mahari, the Mokes were built in factories around the world, notably in Australia and later Portugal, as well as the UK, and from 1963 until the early 90s. In 1961, an unlikely alliance developed between BMC and Formula One constructor Cooper, whose driver, Jack Brabham, had just won two world championships on the trot. Team boss John and son Mike ran the team. Mini Coopers, with engines ranging in size from 970cc, very rare these days, to a 1275cc, were much faster than the regular models, and made it possible for Mini to become a star in many forms of motorsport. The Cooper name was dropped in 1971, but would return later on. Mini Cooper was almost an immediate hit in rallying from club to international events, and later in the related sport of rallycross. Minis were not as powerful as the opposition, but their superior handling enabled such drivers as Rauno Altonen, Tony Fall, Timo Makinen, and Pete Moss, and of course a certain Mr. Hopkirk, to win at the highest level. The Minis, which finished first, second and third in the 1966 Monte Carlo Rally, were among 10 cars disqualified for lighting infringements, leaving victory to the French marque of Citroën. This was widely regarded, especially in the UK, as a fiasco, but might not have been all that bad. It has often been said, and it is possibly true, that disqualifications gave the Mini more publicity than if it had in fact won the event in 64, 65 and 67. The Mini was nearly as successful in circuit racing as it was in rallying. It won the European Touring Car Championship twice and the British Saloon Car Championship, now known as the British Touring Car Championship, BTCC, five times over an extraordinarily long period, 1961 to 1979. One make series for the Mini are still well supported to this day and usually provide exceptionally close racing. In 1969, a new range of Mini saloons and estates was launched in a stylish flat front look. Nearly all of them, and we'll come to the exception in a moment, were given the name Clubman. The Clubman style never completely replaced the round front design of a decade earlier and certainly didn't outlive it. The last Clubman was built in 1980, 20 years before Mini production stopped. The only flat front Mini not called Clubman was the 1275 GT, named after its engine size. It was not as quick as the last Cooper S, which also had a 1275cc engine, but it stayed on the market for much longer. The Cooper S was discontinued in 1971, leaving the 1275 GT as the only truly sporting Mini for the remainder of that decade. Italian company Innocenti, manufacturer of Lambretta scooters, built Minis under licence from the 1960s. Early versions look similar to the British versions, but Innocenti began to use Bertone-styled bodies in 1974 and laterally fitted three-cylinder Daihatsu engines. Minis were also built using predominantly local components in Australia and by the Orthi company in Spain. A version with a glass fibre body is manufactured in Chile during the 1970s, followed by, two decades later, by a similar car built in Venezuela. The car expected to replace the Mini was the Metro, latterly known as the Rover 100. Introduced in 1980, it was larger and more modern and survived for nearly two decades. But it couldn't kill the Mini, which remained in production for 2 years after the Metro had been abandoned. Some parts developed for the Metro found their way back into the Mini, most notably the modernised version of the A-series engine, simply known as the A+. The Cooper name was brought back for higher performance models in 1990 and remained in place when production came to an end 10 years later. BMW respected the association and has continued to use Cooper branding on many of its new generation Minis. It took more than 30 years for a convertible version of the Mini to go to market. The first 75, offered in 1991 and all painted cherry red, were built by Lahm Autohaus and sold out so quickly that Rover Special Products was tasked with creating its own version. This went on sale in 1993 and was initially either Nightfire Red or Caribbean Blue, though British Racing Green became available the next year. The Cabriolet looked odd with the roof down and was very expensive compared with the other Minis, but it was successful enough to remain in production until 1996. That was just Herman. He left the Hermits outside, so he decided he'd better go back and get him. So we'll try him again a bit later on, I think. Special edition Minis were very common in the 90s. One example was the Mini Paul Smith, in conjunction with the British fashion designer. The original car, which appeared in the 1997 Tokyo Motor Show, had 24 colours arranged in 84 stripes. The production cars inspired were even more practical. Paul Smith cars you could actually buy were all available in single colours. In the case of the UK market, which 300 were built. This meant blue, though not all others were offered with the 1500 colours intended for export markets. These models had a specification which would have been unbelievable in 1959, included black leather seats and matching door pockets, and a 24-carat gold-plated Paul Smith badge on the bonnet. The last Minis was the 7, the Cooper and the Cooper S and the Knightsbridge. The very last of all was built on the 4th of October 2000 and immediately presented, appropriately enough, to the British Motor Museum, where it shares a home with 621 AOK, which was the very first, as I mentioned at the very front. In 1996, a three-year process began to choose what was then to be known as the car of the 20th century. Perhaps inevitably, the Ford Model T was awarded that, but esteem for the Mini was so high that it finished second in the round of voting, beating the Citroën DS, the Volkswagen Beetle, and the Porsche 911. And that, folks, is the history and the story, the truncated history and story of the Mini. It was written by David Finlay, and it was originally in the Classic and Sports Car magazine in October of this year.
Long distance information, give me Memphis, Tennessee. Help me find the party, try to get in touch with me. She could not leave her number, but I know who placed the call. 'Cause my uncle took the message and he wrote it on the wall.
Just poking my head out, and Herman and his hermits were roaring off down the street towards Sydney. So Mr. Berry jumped in for us. Thank you, Chuck. Hey, how about this? From drive.com.au, and written by Joshua Dowling, you might remember some time ago we did a series or an episode on the great Charger. Hey, Charger. Well, this is a 1972 Valiant Charger E49 big tank. It's been listed at sale for close to $400,000. The $395,000 asking price isn't a match for the record sums paid for Holden and Ford muscle cars, but it's one of the highest for the Valiant from that same era. Although not in immaculate condition, it is one of only a handful of examples remaining. Say, says representatives of Australian muscle car sales. Valiant built 149 of the Charger E49 in 1972 to qualify for that year's Bathurst Motor Race. Of course, only 21 were equipped with a 160-litre long-range tank to reduce the number of fuel stops, of course. Of those 21 cars, the seller claims only three are in original condition. Photos show this particular 72 Valiant Charger E49 is in very tidy condition, but with 95,819 miles on the odometer, it has signs of age, including the areas of thinning paint and underbody that has seen better times. Regardless, however, the seller says the car will fetch big money because it's of its originality. Of the 21 big tanks that were built, only 14 are left, says seller Mike Selby. Most of these are overbore, ore bodies, O-R-E bodies, and I'm told only three remain in original condition. Mr. Selby says the car has already attracted interest from two buyers, even though it has only been on sale for a week. One is arranging finance, and the other buyer is also sorting out their own arrangements, said Mr. Selby. We're confident it'll go close to them asking price. Under other recent muscle car classics, this example is not a barn find. In other words, folks, it was found in a barn after years of disuse. It has only had three owners, all of whom have been Valiant collectors. The seller is based in Brisbane, and the car is on consignment and on display at the Australian Muscle Car Sales in Sydney. The Valiant E49 was regarded as one of the fastest cars never to win Bathurst. It finished third in the 1972 Enduro behind the Turana XU1, driven by Peter Brock, and the Ford Falcon GTHO Phase 3, driven by Peter French. I beg your pardon, Peter's brother John. According to Sports Car World on October 1972, the stopwatches don't lie. But it's pretty hard to believe. A 0 to 100 miles an hour, that's not k's, in a time of 14.1 seconds. That's really flying. And the engine's no thumping V8 nor quad cam V12. It's Chrysler Australia's 4.3-litre inline-six, a stormer called the Charger RT E49. According to Wheels magazine, the E49 was the fastest accelerating Australian-made muscle car of all, capable of turning the standard quarter mile in 14.1 seconds and clocking 0 to 60 mile an hour in just 6.1. No mean feat for a six-cylinder engine. That's right, faster than a Phase 3 GTHO Falcon. And interestingly, no other six-cylinder car has come close to the mighty E49 Charger in performance until Ford's XR6 Turbo hit the showroom floor some 36 years later in 2008. How about that? Thank you, Joshua Dowling from Drive.com. A 1972 Valiant Charger E49 listed on sale at close to $400,000. I will do some research and find out what it went for, if it in fact has gone. And now the bit you've all been waiting for, some weird and surprising car facts. And we've got a couple this week. We missed out last week, so we go to Auto Car Magazine, weird and surprising car facts for our strange days. So here we go. Auto Car is the world's oldest car magazine, launched in November 1895. As the Auto Car. Just 2 years later, our first editor, Henry Sturmey, was the first man to drive across Britain, from Land's End in the far west to England to John O'Groats in the far northeast of Scotland. 874 miles, it took him 10 days and an average speed of 10 miles an hour. How about this? This is good. When the Titanic sank in 1912, it had a solitary car in its hold, a brand new Renault Type CV Coupe de Ville. The car was bought by William Carter of Pennsylvania while he was touring Europe with his wife and two children. The Renault was then loaded onto the Titanic when the Carters returned home, only to sink to the bottom of the Atlantic, never to be seen again. And yes, it's the car portraying an important role in the blockbusting 1997 movie with director James Cameron's obsession with detail, the original documents were located and a near-exact replica was produced. The Carter family happily all survived the sinking. Auctioneers R.M. Sotheby's sold an example for $270,000 in 2008. Ford is often credited with inventing the moving production line, but the curved dash Oldsmobile was the first mass-produced car in 1901. The Model T didn't appear till 1908. Despite this, Henry Ford took his inspiration from the clockmaking and armaments industries, with his production line cutting manufacturing times as well, from 12.5 hours to just 1.5 hours. Incidentally, the reason why his Model T came only in black for a while was that it was the only colour that dried fast enough to keep up with the rate of production. Last one. The first land speed record was broken in December 1898 by an electric car named Jetor Du, travelling at 39.24 miles an hour. The next five records were all broken by electric cars, which raised the bar to 65.79 miles per hour. The seventh record was broken by a steam car, 75.6 miles per hour. It wasn't until the eighth record that a car powered by an internal combustion engine reigned supreme. That was 1902, when William K. Vanderbilt drove his Moores motor vehicle to 76.03 miles an hour. We've got to have one more, because I like the book 1066 and all that. Well, 1066 and all that. When Daimler launched its new small sedan in 1953, it was called the Conquest. That's because the car was priced in England at 1066, before taxes. And the Norman Conquest of England took place in 1066. 4,568 Conquest sedans were produced by the Time production, which ended in 1958. And that's it. You'll be pleased, I guess. From me, that's it this week. As usual, all over the shop this week, Tommy Cooper's little brother, Minnie, and we had the whole history truncated as it was about the Minnie Miner, how it was designed, where it came from, and the various variations, which was quite interesting, I think. And we had a look at the big Charger E49, which they reckon will get $395,000. Let's wait and see. Thanks for your company. I look forward to catching you next week when we'll talk about something else. Until then, bye for now.